It's Saturday, October 28th. This is PodTech News Weekly. I'm Jason Lopez. Did you know that JibJab is more than an online political cartoon? It's a brand. Also, be careful what you ask for, especially if you're a civil liberties activist. The FBI is finally going from messy paper to computerization, even this late date after 9/11. Video gaming costs are a funny thing. Prices for many players are still at a premium, but the ubiquity of gaming could bring with it the kind of competition that brings prices down. Those stories coming up on PodTech Weekly. You probably know a netaholic, someone who just can't take being separated from his email, eBay, or gaming console. But is this online mania simply a normal response to our increasing dependence on the internet or an addiction that could land a person in a support group or a shrink's office? Catherine Girardeau talks with some doctors and a self-described recovering World of Warcraft game addict.
The internet is a powerful psychoactive medium, meaning it can change mood and behavior and consciousness.
People do exhibit compulsive use. They hide their use. They stay online longer than intended. So basically, you are talking about some kind of clinical entity.
Anyone who has the energy to play World of Warcraft has the energy to do great things in life.
On today's show, internet addiction, fad illness or new pathology? A recent study by Stanford University School of Medicine researchers tries to get closer to the question of whether compulsive internet use merits a medical diagnosis. The researchers' telephone-based study found that more than 1 in 8 American adults exhibited at least one possible sign of problematic or excessive online behavior. We'll talk with clinical psychologists and a self-described survivor of the massive multiplayer online role-playing game, World of Warcraft. This is Catherine Girardeau, PodTech News. Dr. Kimberly Young directs the Center for Online Addiction in Bradford, Pennsylvania, and is an expert on online behavior. How can you compare a behavioral kind of dependency to alcoholism?
What the Stanford study does, as well as my study and other studies, they're all finding the same kinds of things. Basically, you are talking about some kind of clinical entity. We don't separate what that looks like necessarily from drug addiction, which involves a physical inhalant or intoxicant, versus impulse control disorders.
Dr. David Greenfield runs the Center for Technology Behavior in Hartford, Connecticut. He wrote a book called Virtual Addiction.
And you've said internet addiction looks a lot like gambling addiction. What are some of the markers? What are some of the things that you see in patients?
In order to meet the real technical criteria for compulsive internet use, you have to have a lot of negative consequences. And the things that would be included in that are an inability to decrease or cut down or discontinue your use, a recognition by people, friends and family, that your behavior has changed or it has been impacted. Spending greater and greater amounts of time online and or involving yourself in more stimulating content online. A negative impact in some major sphere of your life, which would be work, school, home life, primary relationship, children, legal status, financial status, health. But the bottom line is, the most important criteria is, the greater the amount of time you're spending online on a consistent basis, along with the recognition by other people who know your life pattern that there's some shift in your personality or your behavior, are probably the two greatest markers.
Where do you draw the line between someone who enjoys and uses the internet as a source of entertainment, social interaction, information, and someone who you would call an internet addict?
Dr. Kimberly Young.
Obviously, there is a big issue between differentiating, say, normal drinkers from heavy drinkers to alcoholics. And the same thing applies to the internet. Certainly isn't a matter of time, no more than it is a matter of looking at the number of drinks somebody consumes to diagnose alcoholism. You're really looking at, how is this affecting a person? Is it debilitating? Can they quit? And what kinds of problems is that particular behavior causing?
Yeah, what kinds of problems? Both psychologists I talked to mentioned massive multiplayer online role-play gaming as one of the primary seducers of potential internet addicts. So I called up Gary Huran in Montreal. Gary runs a website called World of Warcraft Detox, on which players and ex-players of the Blizzard Entertainment game World of Warcraft can, quote, tell the world your reasons for leaving the addicting game. Gary, what led you to start a detox blog for World of Warcraft addicts?
To make a long story short, when I decided to quit, I noticed that a lot of people were coming to me with their stories on why they wanted to quit the game as well. And I thought that a site where they could post anonymously their reasons would encourage others to do so as well.
What was your experience with World of Warcraft?
It was my first MMORPG ever. So I went from casual gamer to a guild leader for one of the greatest guilds on the site. It was like the third highest ranked at the time I was guild leader. It took about a year. In the first couple of months, I just learned how the game worked, and I met some really nice people who were, you know, a little bit more hardcore gamers than the usual bunch. You have lots of great moments in World of Warcraft. The problem is how long every subsequent step takes.
What is the power of a guild leader?
Every guild actually creates its own form of government. The stuff that I had to do was to make sure that we had all the resources to take on new bosses. So I would delegate work to different people. There'd be one person who'd be in charge of our voice server, and there would be another person who'd be responsible for gathering herbs and spices. I was the person orchestrating all of that, making sure that everything was done so that we could move forward in the game.
How much time were you spending in World of Warcraft?
I'd get home from work at around 6, and I'd be getting to bed at around 1, 1:30 in the morning. And then I'd be up in the morning at 7 to go to work. I didn't get much sleep.
Why did you feel you needed to quit? It doesn't sound like that time block would necessarily be so disruptive to someone's life.
When I was at home, I mean, I'm married, I have a wife, and I just didn't have time for her anymore. When you have almost 100 people who want you to be available because they have questions, they want to know what we're going to do next, you cannot press the pause button on this game. That's a very important reason why I decided that I had enough. You become this father figure, I guess. You always have to be there for them. Otherwise, they might go to another guild. And when people leave your guild, you have to start recruiting again, train the people, gear them up so that they're ready to kill those bosses with us. And the whole process is so time-consuming that, you know, the people in the guild are very important to you. So you put a lot of time trying to please them and make sure that they're okay with what we do.
What inspired you to quit? Was it somebody else in your life coming to you, telling you you're spending too much time online, or how did it happen for you?
I mean, my wife did mention a few times that she'd like to spend more time with me, so I tried to make more time for her. Unfortunately, not enough, and it was pretty much me. I decided that I had enough with the game. It was more work than it was a game, actually, at the end.
Did you quit cold turkey, or do you play any kind of games casually now?
I quit cold turkey. I joined the best guild on my server, and the next morning after doing a raid with them, I quit cold turkey. I was at work, and I just decided to hit the unsubscribe button from the website. And I didn't play games for a couple weeks. Then I bought a couple games that I could hit pause on.
Do you blame the game itself for your addiction? Would you characterize your playing as an addiction?
Oh, yes. It's kind of hard to admit that to yourself, that you're addicted to a game. But there's numerous aspects of the game that I can blame on Blizzard for making it that way. And there are some aspects that I can blame myself. I mean, you got a character that you connect to because you're the one controlling his every move and deciding every aspect of that character. So you get really attached to it. The other aspect is the social one. I mean, you make bonds with people, and like, you're a hero in this game, so, you know, it can create some pretty strong bonds. At the same time, they're very fragile. I mean, you don't see somebody become a friend as easily with someone whose class doesn't complement your own. In real life, you don't meet someone and ask them, do you complement an aspect of me? I mean, you talk to the person, you get to know them, and if they're interesting, they have more chance to be your friend. In World of Warcraft, if you're a healer class and the person's a tank, then you've got more chances to be friends with that person rather than, you know, if the person's interesting or not.
Do you think there were other factors in your life during the time you were gaming that led you to spend so much time playing World of Warcraft?
Yeah, I did have a mild case of depression. I hated my job. I really hated it. It was the most boring job ever. And having a game that could allow me to forget about it was really easy.
There were up to like 8,300 posts on your blog, just people telling why they quit World of Warcraft or why they want to quit. Do you think the people who post on your blog tend to be, you know, addictive in some other way? Or do you think it's the game that's pulling people in and causing them to get addicted?
There's always something that, you know, once we start doing it, we can't really stop. But I don't think that everyone who gets addicted to World of Warcraft has the prototypical addictive personality. I mean, I never really gambled that much. I went to the casino a couple times, never spending more than $20. However, having a game that I couldn't beat, that was too much for me to handle. I mean, I beat almost every game that I've, you know, laid my hands on. And having finally found a game that was so hard, At first I was thrilled because, you know, hey, this game is hard to beat. It takes me longer to beat it, so I'm enjoying it. But at the same time, you know, I was looking at the tunnel. I was thinking, I have to beat this game, and it's unbeatable. And that's really what got to me, is that no end zone where you can try and try and try and you'll never get there. And if you do, it's just a matter of weeks before Blizzard comes out with something.
While studies on compulsive internet use are hardly conclusive, oddly enough, the two experts I talked to who either said or have been quoted in the press as saying they didn't believe internet addiction was a clinical disorder didn't want to go on the record with those opinions. Dr. Peter Banas of the University of California, San Francisco's VA hospital said he's generally against the, quote, proliferation of addictions such as compulsive shopping. A professor of human-computer interaction at Carnegie Mellon University, Sarah Kiesler, was quoted by the New York Times calling internet addiction a fad illness. At this point, the consensus in the medical and academic community seems to be that not enough study has been done to determine whether internet addiction is actually a distinct mental disorder. But skeptics aside, Dr. David Greenfield of the Center for Technology Behavior said basically, a spade is a spade, no matter what you call it.
There are a number of people, you know, thousands and thousands, that have something going on with their compulsive use of the internet in a way that we've not seen before with other forms of communications or technology. And if you go, if you speak with any group of mental health professionals, half to three quarters will say that they have seen in their practice people who have issues with this. All addictions really are about numbing pain, and then that pattern of numbing and pleasure seeking becomes habitual, most probably because of elevated levels of dopamine, which is consistent across many behavioral and substance-based addictions.
While internet addiction is unlikely to be the next global pandemic, take it from the experts. If you experience cold sweats when you're offline, you might want to consider getting professional help. Or a real life. For PodTech News, I'm Catherine Giraudot in Menlo Park, California.
The FBI took a lot of heat post 9/11 for their lack of sophisticated technology. The agency had to admit that it still kept paper files on suspects and that its countless computer systems were not only out of date, but couldn't even talk to each other. Recently, the FBI has been trying to shed that image by showcasing some of its high-tech data collection and retention systems. Civil liberties watchdogs, though, are concerned about what the FBI is using and how it's using it. PodTech's Clark Boyd has the story.
On today's podcast, the FBI has been showcasing what it calls one of its toughest tools in the fight against terrorism. It's a searchable database called the Investigative Data Warehouse, or IDW. It contains more than 650 million records. According to the FBI, the IDW includes photographs, biographical information, physical location information, and financial data for use in anti-terrorism investigations. Officials involved in the IDW project even claim it can, quote, scale to the size of the entire internet. But those officials have been tight-lipped when it comes to providing precise details on the IDW. And that lack of disclosure has some folks wondering what the FBI's database means for American civil liberties.
When the country's premier law enforcement agency is maintaining a database like that and can use it to make decisions about people and assess people, that's a very big concern.
That's Marsha Hoffman, staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Marsha and her colleagues have been following news of the IDW for a while now. They wanted to know, first and foremost, whose records are being kept and how are they being collected. So they sent a Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, request to the FBI. The FBI didn't respond, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit. I reached Marsha Hoffman by phone at her Washington office. I started by asking her what we do know about the FBI's investigative data warehouse.
Most of what we know comes from newspaper reports, especially recent ones, because the FBI held a press conference within the past couple of months to show off its investigative abilities with this database. You know, the FBI has been criticized a lot over the past few years for its failure to implement really good, solid, effective technology, and so the FBI has held up this database as an example of how excellent its current technology is. But, you know, we're interested in, you know, how it works, what sort of information is in it, what laws govern the use of the information and the maintenance of the information, and how long that sort of information is retained, whether it's disclosed to anybody else. So that's the sort of stuff that we're interested in.
Do we have a sense of what kind of information they are gathering with this or not really?
Well, we know it's a very comprehensive database. It's not clear what all information it includes, but from public statements made by FBI officials, it seems that there are some telecommunications records in this database, general law enforcement information. There are questions about whether there's airline information in it, like passenger name records that airlines or travel agents would have. So, you know, that is, of course, one of the things that we're very interested in, is trying to learn the universe of the information in there.
We have a very limited sense of what they're gathering. Do we have any sense of sort of the process here about how they're gathering it? I mean, what are the methods that they're using here?
Well, you know, that's certainly another thing that we are looking to uncover with this lawsuit. We don't know a tremendous amount of information about how this is maintained, what processes the government uses to pull this information together, and also, again, what laws govern that. It would seem pretty clear that the Privacy Act would govern the way that this database is maintained. The Privacy Act is a law that requires the government to take certain measures when it collects information about people in what they call a system of records. And it seems very clear that this is a system of records, but it seems also that certain provisions of the Privacy Act have not been followed here. Things like notifying the public officially that this database exists and letting people know what information is in it, and how they can make sure that information is accurate.
Right. Well, I guess the question is, from a listener's point of view, might be, well, what's the big deal about this? We're, you know, we have terrorist threats against us. We're looking to the FBI and organizations like that to keep tabs. Why would the EFF want to bring this suit?
Well, the big deal about this database is that it could possibly include information about completely innocent people, and there's no way to know how long that information is kept, how it's used, who else it's given to, and whether or not it's kept up to date and accurate. And when the country's premier law enforcement agency is maintaining a database like that and can use it to make decisions about people and assess people, that's a very big concern.
So you're bringing this lawsuit and you're using the Freedom of Information Act to try to get this information. Maybe listeners have heard of the Freedom of Information Act, but they don't necessarily understand how it works. Can you give them a sense of how it does work and how groups like EFF can use it?
The Freedom of Information Act is a federal law that gives every person the right to ask the government for information about its activities. And the government has to release that information unless it has a really good reason to withhold it. You know, the specific reasons why the government can withhold information are very specifically set out in the law. And there, you know, there are things like national security, that information is classified, that information is law enforcement, that information is sort of in draft form and not a final decision. And there are good reasons behind all of these, but if information has to be disclosed, it has to be disclosed. And my organization is interested in using this tool to get information from the government that isn't otherwise public, that reflects the way that the government uses technology to collect information about people, to conduct surveillance, and to otherwise perform activities that might infringe upon civil liberties. And we're also interested in seeing the way that the government coordinates with the private sector to develop technology along these lines to keep tabs on what the public does.
Marcia, is your sense, having worked in this now for the last few years, that the pendulum is kind of swinging back, that the public is becoming aware that, you know, perhaps the government is violating some of their civil liberties or keeping information on them, you know, even though they may be innocent? I mean, is there a sense that people are kind of saying, now hold on, wait a minute, we really do need the government to tell us what they're doing?
Yeah, I would agree that that's the case. You know, I think that after 9/11, people tended to feel extremely cautious about security versus privacy. And most people felt that if one had to yield to the other, it should obviously be privacy yielding to security. But I think that we've moved forward enough to realize that we haven't had anything resembling a 9/11 since 9/11. And, you know, I think that people understand that there is a balance to be struck and we cannot sacrifice civil liberties in the name of security.
Now, I wanted to make a point that this is part of a larger effort by the Electronic Frontier Foundation called the FLAG Project. Can you tell me what FLAG stands for and then tell me a little bit about the project more broadly?
The FLAG acronym stands for FOIA Litigation for Accountable Government. And, you know, basically, our project involves making Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get as many records from the government as we can about issues involving civil liberties and technology and the way that technology affects civil liberties, and making that available to the public, and also making sure that decision makers have access to that information.
Right. Now, I noticed that there was another suit that was filed against the FBI. Was it a little bit earlier this month?
That's right. It was a few weeks ago. The Department of Justice Inspector General released a report earlier this year that mentioned two electronic surveillance systems that the FBI had developed to intercept communications. And these were systems that we realized aren't known very well by the public. There's not a great deal of information out there. And so we submitted a FOIA request to the FBI to ask for information about these systems. And the FBI didn't respond, and so we filed a lawsuit.
So do we know anything about these technologies at all?
Well, the most comprehensive description that I've seen of these technologies is in this report that I mentioned, the Justice Department Inspector General's report. One of them is called Red Hook, and I have been unable to find further information about that. The other is called DCS 3000. This is a surveillance technology that appears to have been around for a few years, and as of the time that the report was published, it still was in use by the FBI.
It sounds almost like an offshoot of the Total Information Awareness or Carnivore or something like that.
Well, it is worth noting that Carnivore was later renamed DCS 1000, and this is DCS 3000.
Do you think it's likely that the FBI will be forced to open up?
I don't think that the FBI will give us everything that they have on it because, you know, these are obviously systems that involve law enforcement, and that sort of information is clearly going to be protected by the Freedom of Information Act and won't be disclosed to the public. But certainly when the existence of Carnivore became public a few years ago, Freedom of Information Act lawsuits were instrumental in prying out information about how the technology worked, making enough information available to the public so that we knew that there were privacy implications that were very distressing. And so it is my hope that we'll get information like that out of this lawsuit.
Marcia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There has been, as yet, no official response to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit. Marcia Hoffman says that if the government needs more time to process the formal legal requests, it now needs to explain why to a court. And if it doesn't need more time, she says, then information on the IDW, DCS 3000, and Red Hook should be released immediately. And that's all for this PodTech podcast. In Boston, I'm Clark Boyd, reminding you to visit podtech.net for all the latest technology news.
It's been a while since we've heard from JibJab, the comedy company that launched the animated spoof This Land Is Your Land during the 2004 presidential election cycle. What's the company up to now? Will there be another parody for the 2006 midterm elections, just a little more than 1 week away? PodTech's Matt Kelly caught up with one of the company's founders and files this report.
The Spiridellis brothers, Greg and Evan, have become internet superstars since the debut of their animation that satirized political candidates in mid to late 2004. The viral political animation video, This Land Is Your Land, and their follow-up, Good to Be in D.C., made for The Tonight Show, garnered 80 million views during the 2004 election. Quite a feat when you consider this was pre-YouTube. The two brothers began their venture in the Internet's heyday of the late 1990s when they realized the potential for independent content producers with little to no money.
My brother and I started the company back in 1999. I was a recovering investment banker, we say, and doing my MBA at the time, and Evan was an independent filmmaker, and he was making incredible little digital films with, you know, off the shelf consumer-grade equipment matched with the Internet, this open platform that allowed anybody to kind of create something and get it out to an audience, created a really big opportunity for independent creators. And not having come from the entertainment world, we didn't realize how silly the idea of starting our own brand was, our own entertainment brand. So we set up shop in Brooklyn in 1999, and our timing was really good. We hit the first web, you know, kind of online entertainment bubble, and we're licensing original content to other sites, like Adam Shockwave was a partner from way back in the day. And then when the market crashed, basically all our clients went out of business within 6 months, and my brother and I packed up shop and moved out to L.A., and that was in 2002. And then 2004, we published This Land, which is the animation that really kind of got things rolling for us.
The inspiration for the political comedy clip was obvious, Spiridellis notes, and began with a spoof in 2000 between then-candidates George Bush and Al Gore, and was made in very little time for almost no money, yet saw an unprecedented response in a time before the advent of viral video sites. He notes its success was an early testament to the power of social media.
In 2000, we had created a Bush-Gore rap battle, and by the standards of 2000, it was a huge success. I think we did about 5 million views, and it was licensed by Mad TV. So, presidential elections provide a really unique time where the whole country, really the whole world, is focused on one story for an extended period of time. And unlike, events that just happen, Dick Cheney getting shot in the face, I mean, when the conventions are coming, you can plan a production calendar to kind of get something out for the conventions, and then it's going to be the number one story for 3 or 4 months, so you've got relevant content. The problem with, producing original content for the web is the shelf life is so short, but in the presidential elections, you have, like, a really nice window to get your work out there. So, it was very intentional to produce something for the election, and, it was just, where does the creative inspiration come from? Who knows, but it was probably a result of, you know, frustration at the stupidity of the political dialogue at the time. And, you know, we came up with the idea. I, you know, wrote it. My brother designs and animates. And at the time, there were only the two of us. We had gone from about 13 people in Brooklyn. We moved out here. It was literally just the two of us, and we'd staff up on jobs, you know, working for corporate clients, and then we'd take some of the money we made and then take, you know, 8 weeks we took to make this land. And so the budget was our time and, you know, the opportunity cost of not doing work that would pay us. So there is no, not necessarily a budget. You know, all of the technology is, you know, consumer-grade stuff. We use Photoshop and Flash to make this land and, you know, some consumer-grade audio technologies to kind of cut it up. So it was, you know, just very, very low budget. By the time we'd created this land, we'd been producing and distributing online entertainment for 4.5 years. And, you know, we had seen some success before. I mentioned the 2000 Bush Gore piece. In 2004, we did an Arnold for Governor piece that really, you know, kind of made the rounds. And so, you know, typically when we had a success at that time, we'd see, you know, 40,000 visitors the first day. And when we released This Land, it was 100,000. The next day, it was like 500,000. And it just got completely out of control really quickly. You know, we've always known that that distribution is in your audience. So if you create something of value with some entertainment value, that what you want to do is make sure you give your audience the tools to be your champion and to leverage your audience to be your distribution network. And This Land is the primary example of that. You know, the only marketing we did for This Land was we sent one email to our newsletter base, which was our fan base, which was about 130,000 people at the time. That one email cost about $400. That was the only marketing we did, and the viral distribution took care of the rest. We hit this positive feedback circle where it created such a buzz online that it started getting covered offline, which drove more people online, and you know we wound up getting tons of media coverage, and that was really the idea. That was why we created it. We wanted people to hear about and know about the Jib Jab brand.
So the video's popularity was clearly evident to the public early on, but what was the reaction from the candidates themselves?
We have heard through the media, so we've heard, you know, the head of the RNC make a comment and the DNC, but the only person we met in person was Al Gore, and it was an event in New York, and someone said, you know, you should meet Al Gore, and we were terrified because we had put him in the gutter with a "We'll work for food" sign. And we're like, oh, no, I hope he hasn't seen that. And the first thing he did is come over and say, you guys put me in the gutter with a "will work for food" sign. And he was laughing about it, and he was good-spirited about it. So
the company has grown tremendously since then, Spiridella says, and has gotten the attention of some of the biggest Internet companies, as well as one of Hollywood's best-known directors, John Landis.
We were able to kind of leverage the success we had in the election to do a distribution deal. So we did a distribution deal with first Adam Films and then Yahoo and then MSN. So it enabled us to fund kind of our next batch of original programming. And we also did some corporate work for Anheuser-Busch to kind of fund the business. And because regardless of 80 million views, the monetization, it's not like an established industry. Like, you sell 80 million CDs, you're going to be rich. You know, with us, we had this huge success, and it enabled us to kind of capitalize the business for another year. So we kept, you know, building, and our goal has always been for Jib Jab to be a comedy brand, a broad comedy brand. So this year we launched something called Joke Box, which is kind of a user-generated comedy content channel on Jib Jab. And the idea there was to really create a place where people could come and share the funniest viral stuff, not only videos, but photos, text jokes, audio jokes, kind of create a joke-sharing community that would create, you know, would give people a reason to come back to Jib Jab every day while we were in the middle of our production cycles, because the problem in the past for us has always been, you know, we release something every 3 months, we have huge surges in traffic, and then it kind of goes away, and then we have another piece and big bump. So Joke Box was really to help us smooth out that traffic a little bit and to, you know, to build out the Jib Jab brand, both with Joke Box and also to fill up our development pipeline so we're producing more original stuff. We raised our first round of capital in June of 2006 after being in business for 6.5 years with Polaris Venture Partners. We did a deal with Adam Films, and they were selling, and you know, we were sharing the ad revenue from pre-rolls, not only off of their site, but also off of our own site as well. So the pre-roll video ads are great, and that's how we've done our deals with Yahoo and MSN Video. MSN Video is great. They do a great job of monetizing, you know, the original content that they've licensed from us. So, you know, because we were self-funded for 6.5 years, we were, you know, making, you know, we were definitely profitable. I mean, that was, the profits were what were funding the growth of the business. And now with the, you know, the launch of Jokebox, we're building out our original pipeline. We think things like we just launched called the Great Sketch Experiment, which was sponsored by Verizon Wireless, you know, that there's a big opportunity for us to create high-quality comedy programming and attract premium sponsors like Verizon. Like when we launched Jokebox, we launched it with Bud Light as the sponsor. So sponsorships is, you know, really our business model. John, who directed Blues Brothers, Animal House, Trading Places, Coming to America, Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, I mean, the greatest comedy director, you know, of our lifetime at least, worked with us on a project. We believe that there's a vast untapped pool of talent out there that doesn't have the opportunities to really break through in traditional media. And so we want Jib Jab to be a platform for that talent the same way it was for Evan and myself. So we had a contest, and we had 50 scripts come in from across the country, and 6 were selected for John Landis to direct. And so we shot 6 police-themed sketch comedy shorts with John Landis with these troops from Seattle, New York, San Fran, and L.A., and now they're up on JibJab.com, and the audience is voting you know, for the winning sketch, and the winner gets a $10,000 development deal with us. And the cool thing is the site is sponsored by Verizon Wireless, the project is sponsored, but you can also stream the videos on the VCast service on Verizon Wireless.
This is Morgan Freeman. What you're about to see is a blatant maiming of one of the greatest movies ever made, The Shawshank Redemption.
Please state your name.
I'm Andy Dufresne.
You're on trial for murder in the state of Maine. You murdered your wife and we found where she was buried.
You mean Susan Sarandon? We're not really married.
No, your wife in the movie.
I didn't do it. Please don't doubt it.
I sentence you to life.
But,
no buts about it.
That was one of the finalists for Jib Jab's Great Sketch Experiment. The video is called Shawshank in a Minute and stars the sketch comedy troupe Famous Last Nerds. Spirit Ellis feels that this type of media is the future of entertainment.
The challenge is, how do you create great creative without spending hundreds of thousands of dollars for every production, because the economics can't support hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, you know, if you're good, you can, the economics can support $20,000 productions. So the challenge is, how do you create a production model where you can produce quality content at a low enough price point where it can be, you know, profitable. You know, I was on a panel with Ross Levinson from Fox Interactive yesterday, and he said it best. He said, this is the best time to be in media. It's the most exciting time. The rules of the old game are out the window, and there's huge opportunities for creators that have, you know, creators and small independent creative studios like Jib Jab that have never been able to reach an audience directly. But now, thanks to production technology costs falling, I mean, any Best Buy carries all the equipment you need to make a good video, and, you know, with broadband, you know, penetration where it's at and computer processing power where it's at, people can make things and get an audience if they're good. And that's, you know, that's knocked the gates down. All the gatekeepers to the audience, you know, traditional gatekeepers to an audience are gone. And what the internet lets you do is not only get your work out there, but also to connect with that audience. So, you know, now we have over 700,000 people on our newsletter. You know, that means we can go back out to those people when we have something new. So it lets us basically build our own, you know, direct relationship with an audience as a small studio, and that's never before been possible. This is the best time to be in media, because all of the gates are coming down, and little guys like us, if you're smart and you work hard and you do good work, you can get to an audience. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I believe that the brands that are being built today are the brands that are going to be the Comedy Central, CNNs, and, you know, other, you know, great media brands that were built when cable, first came around. So I think that, you know, that opportunity is open for the taking.
And with the November 2006 midterm elections just a short time away, will we see another political animation video from Jib Jab? Sadly, no. It's something we'll have to wait for until 2008. I'm Matt Kelly in Los Angeles.
This land is your land. This land is my land. I'm a Texas tiger. You're a liberal wiener. I'm a great crusader. You're a Herman Munster. This land will surely vote for me.
This land is your land. This land is my land. I'm an intellectual. You're a stupid dog.
Price could be a key weapon in the next generation console war between Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft. But a recent report by research firm Interpret suggests price will not matter when the Sony PlayStation 3 and Nintendo Wii hit store shelves next month. Interpret Chief Strategy Officer Jason Kramer and Wedbush Morgan Securities analyst Michael Pachter spoke with PodTech's Rio Pacino and gave their thoughts on the report.
This is Rio Pacino for PodTech.net. Let's see here. The Sony PlayStation 3, I'm looking at spending about $500 to $600. And I'm going to have a game. And that will cost me about $60. And I'm also going to need an extra wireless controller. That's going to cost me another $50. Despite the fact that I'll be spending about $700 to $800. Hey, owning a next-gen gaming console, it's priceless. But is it really that priceless? Sony's PlayStation 3 and Nintendo's Wii, which is priced at $250, will be on store shelves next month just in time for the holiday season. Microsoft's Xbox 360 has been out for almost a year now and costs about $300 to $400. And those prices don't include tax, don't include games or accessories, or the HD TV required to take full advantage of the systems, with the exception of the Wii, which is not HD compatible. But history tells us video game consoles fly off the shelves regardless of price. So in today's world, does price really matter when it comes to buying a next-gen system? A new report by research firm Interpret suggests price is simply an afterthought.
Well, this is part of a major report we did on new media called Interpreting the New Media Landscape. And one of the things we looked at was which new consoles were going to, quote-unquote, win the battle and who was actually going to buy them. With our research, we found that consumers are incredibly excited about the PS3. And by a long shot, there are about 8.9 million consumers who want to buy a PlayStation 3 at full price at launch. That's great news, and it bodes well for the long term. The challenge is that with Sony shipping maybe 500,000 to a million consoles, it'll be really difficult for people to get their hands on one. One question is, what will people do? Will they wait, or will they switch to the Xbox 360 or the Nintendo Wii? One interesting thing that we looked at in the data is cross-ownership of platforms. Interestingly enough, the Xbox and Xbox 360 owners, about half of them own a PS2. So there's, you know, somewhat crossover there, but not as much as everyone thinks. There's much more crossover between GameCube owners and PS2 owners, probably because there's so many PS2s out there. And that's about two-thirds of the GameCube audience owns a PS2. What we think is interesting there is that if Nintendo has the supply and also the hype, one thing that PS3 and Wii will have going that Xbox 360, you know, may not have as much of is just all of the hype about launching a new console. And there's a lot to be said for that. And we may see that PS3 buyers who can't pick up a console will either wait or switch to the Wii. And about 5.7 million consumers, so even more than will ship, say that they'll buy the Nintendo Wii at full price when it ships.
That was Jason Kramer, Chief Strategy Officer for Interpret. He believes consumers are insensitive to price when it comes to must-have products, including the latest video game consoles.
Price matters less than you think. And this is mostly because gamers are so enthusiastic. Gamers' enthusiasm translates into a level of price insensitivity. Now, that's not to say that everyone wants to fork over $400 or $500 for a PS3, but we're talking about a super scarce commodity here. You'll likely see PS3s on eBay for $1,000 and up. And with the enthusiasm in the category, you really get less price sensitivity to a console launch.
Those people who plan to buy a PS3 to sell it on eBay, was that taken into consideration while taking the survey?
Well, I mean, the survey is a general sample. We did 2,000 consumers, 13 to 54. So there's no particular bias towards hardcore gamers. It's representative of everyone. I'm sure there are maybe two or three people in our sample who may have considered that, but that's about it. We're reflecting that, but it's going to be probably a few isolated cases, but ones that will be well publicized.
Did you feel that you guys got a proper cross-section of the population with this report?
Yeah, actually, it's a really rigorous methodology, and it's kind of unusual for the game space, because we actually did three surveys, a main online survey of 2,000 consumers, and because online panels sometimes have a skew to them, we wanted to do a telephone survey as well, offline survey, to make sure that we were representing the population correctly. And so we actually did two. We did one among adults 18-plus and one among teens 12 to 17. And those actually, that data altogether, we weighted to the 2004 U.S. Census. So it's pretty rigorous. I mean, that said, this is a measure of consumer sentiment. So, you know, at the time of our survey, there's a lot of excitement about the PS3 and the Nintendo Wii.
Now, of the 8.9 million U.S. consumers who are prepared to pay full price for the PS3, how many of those 8.9 million fall under, say, the middle to low income bracket?
I would have to look that up. So I wouldn't want to guess on it. It's definitely something we asked. I just wasn't able to look it up before the call.
Was income taken into account as well when conducting this survey?
Yes. It's represented by income, and you know, I said that traditionally gamers have been sort of price insensitive when it comes to the new platform launches. You've also got a lot of people, you know, keep in mind that that there's not going to be a lot of inventory out there. And if somebody's selling a console for $1,000 on eBay, there's also somebody who's going to come out and buy it.
But Wedbush Morgan Securities analyst Michael Pachter believes there are some problems with Interpret's report.
My understanding is that they talked about a much smaller number being interested in buying an Xbox 360, and that sounded quite a bit skewed to me. They also, you know, talk about people who are prepared to buy. At the end of the day, you know, there's only something like probably 60 or 70 million households in the U.S. and Europe that ever purchased a PS2, 68 I think it is, that purchased a PS2, period, at any price. So to say 8 million will pay full price or 9 million, that sounds like a lot. I would guess that half of all console purchases, if not more, are gifts. And I cannot believe that gift givers have made up their mind that they're buying one or what they're going to pay. I would also imagine most mothers don't even know there is a PS3 out because they haven't asked their kid what they want for Christmas yet. And the PS3 is not out. It hasn't been marketed. So gift givers should be excluded from that survey. They probably don't know any better. And I think an 8.9 million extrapolation at full price for actual consumers who are buying for their own account is probably a bit overstated.
How about your thoughts on the survey being done online? You think that may have skewed the numbers a bit as well?
I'm certain. I mean, that clearly, you know, people who are online tend to be younger and tend to be more educated. You know, obviously people without PCs aren't online, so you're excluding households that don't own a PC, which tends to be a socioeconomic indicator. Younger people, I think, don't appreciate what things really cost. I speak from experience having children, and, you know, they're willing to pay anything for anything. You know, my kids would buy a Maserati if they could. They have no idea what they cost.
Participants in the survey were between the ages of 12 and 54, so...
And certainly, I mean, I'm on the high end of that range, and of course I'm on the internet all day long. So, you know, I don't mean to suggest that, no one above the age of 30 ever goes on the Internet. I just mean that the average user is probably heavily skewed toward a younger user. And I don't mean younger like kid. I mean younger like 20s as opposed to 50s. So, you know, I think that the demographic probably had a, you know, a bell curve, an average or median age of probably something in the low to mid 20s. And of course those people tend to be more self-indulgent than the average gift giver. And, you know, I think 50% of all hardware purchases are made by moms. They just are. And it, you know, that's why you see the surge in console sales at Christmas. So, you know, we know that the console purchaser is older and is female, and we know that the Internet user is younger and, in the case of games, is probably male. So I think that there's just a bias, you know, period, in that kind of a survey.
Pachter also believes price does matter when it comes to video game purchases, especially for the hardcore gamer.
The hardcore gamer is defined more by age and sex than anything. And I think hardcore gamers are 12 to 25-year-old males, period. I think that those hardcore gamers come from all socioeconomic classes. So you have, you know, 16-year-old boys who live in households that have under $40,000 household income. They're not getting a PS3 this Christmas. They would love one, and they do consider themselves hardcore, but the family can't afford it, so it's not happening. The early adopters tend to be affluent people, and when you have, you know, household income of $200,000 or more, it's easy to say, I don't care if the box is $300 or $400 or $500. When you have a household income of $40,000, you care a lot about the difference between $250 and $500 or $600. So, you know, I think that the press, I think that investors, you know, I think that most surveyors just don't appreciate this fact. You know, when you look at Sony PS2 sell-through, they sold 300,000 consoles last month in the U.S. at 129. My question was, what were those people waiting for? Because the box was cut to 199 in 2002. And they only sold 400,000 in September 2002. But honestly, there are people who just said at 199 it was too expensive, and they waited four more years for it to come down to 129. There are just people who are like that. I think that if you are a kid, an unemployed, you know, student in a household, you don't have any money. You're waiting for dad or mom to buy it for you as a gift. Doesn't make you any less hardcore. You know, you really love playing games, and they probably play online, but they have trouble, you know, getting the console until the family can afford it. So I think pricing matters a lot. Most consumers have experience with the console manufacturers that prices come down pretty dramatically over time. And I think that most consumers look at a $400, $500, or $600 box and figure it's going to be $150 someday. I'll wait.
So will price determine who wins the next-gen console battle?
I think that the data says pretty clearly that PlayStation 3 is positioned to win the console war, despite the price point. I mean, consumers expect the price to drop eventually, and actually, if you look at that, who will say this, says they'll eventually buy it, you've got an audience that goes from 9 million to 36 million. So there are a lot of people waiting in the wings there. You've got incredible brand strength for Sony and PS3. And a gaming audience that has a really strong enthusiast base that doesn't tend to be as price sensitive. I mean, you really get to the price sensitivity when the price starts to drop later in the console life cycle. So it really looks like PS3 will come out ahead, and then we really think the battle is going to be for second place, with Nintendo making a really strong showing in the survey, and Xbox 360 is sort of like the established player at this time in the market, with some strong offerings as well.
I think the Wii will sell about 25% of its expected lifetime units in the first couple of years, and then only 50% in the last 3 or 4 years, where I think that the PS3 and the 360 are going to sell something closer to 15% of their lifetime units in each of their first couple of years, and 70% in their last 3 or 4 years. So they're going to be elongated because of their price point, and the Wii will be accelerated because of its price point. I also think there's a dynamic that's going to show up, manifest itself at holiday and beyond, where many households, probably 40%, own at least two game devices, a console and a handheld, or two consoles, or even two consoles and a handheld. And I think that 40%, this next cycle, is going to think very seriously about buying the Wii first. This time around, because of price and because the Wii is so different, so that will result in higher initial Wii sales than people expect and lower initial PS3 sales than people expect. And so my guess is that when you and I speak in July of next year, you're going to be asking me, is Nintendo the winner of this cycle? I don't think they're going to win, but I think they're going to finish very strongly, and I think this really is a three-horse race.
This is Rio Pacino for PodTech.net.
And that's PodTech News Weekly for October 28th, 2006. I'm Jason Lopez. We had help tonight from editor Michael Klinger, reporters Rio Pacino, Matt Kelly, Clark Boyd, and Catherine Girardot.